History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold, and they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then take the time to listen as memories that may have been buried down deep for a long, long time begin to emerge again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired when we consider what these men and women have done, what they've contributed, what they've endured on our behalf. At Hometown Heroes, we like to view every day as Veterans Day, but this is that time of year when our entire country takes pause to recognize everyone who has ever served in our armed forces. Maybe you've heard it said that if Memorial Day is when we recognize that some gave all, then Veterans Day is a way to remember that all gave some. And often, those of us who have never worn the uniform may not fully grasp just how much was given. Today we're going to hear the memories of a couple of World War II veterans, but also pick up perspective from a much younger veteran. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, I realize I'm probably preaching to the choir a bit, but if you haven't taken the time to specifically thank each of the veterans in your circle this week, make that a point today. Bakersfield, California is a city that loves its veterans. The Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial, spearheaded by an energetic World War II veteran who we met on this program, Walter Granger, will be officially dedicated in Bakersfield now on December 10th, so put that on your calendar. But that city had its annual Veterans Day parade on November 11th, like so many other areas where you may be tuning in from today. But unless you were at the Bakersfield Veterans Day parade, you probably didn't get to see a Grand Marshal who was celebrating his 102nd birthday on Veterans Day. Victor Killingsworth was born on November 11th, 1920. He's the author of a book called The Gator Navy, detailing some of the experiences he had in amphibious vessels in the Pacific, such as the invasion of Saipan in 1944.
We got into Saipan that morning on the LS2, worked our way up through the ships. There are hundreds and hundreds of ships. The island was afire, smoking, burning. Our battleships have been pounding for days, our cruisers and destroyers, and then we even had gunships that were firing 20 millimeter shells in close. We pulled in there and put our boats in the water and got ready for the landing operation. And as we were getting ready, the cruiser Indianapolis pulled right in the beach where we were supposed to go in, and I thought, this is a disaster. How are we going to get past the ship? And we had never trained to split the wave and go around them, so I took a chance and signaled for the boys to split the wave and go around, and they did. We went on front and aft of the Annapolis and then came back together in front of it, and she fired over our heads while we were going in. I could see these 8-inch shells, 10-inch, whatever they were. They're slow. Their velocity is slow. You can actually see them, you know, going in to the beach ahead of us.
I don't think you ever saw any of those in Taft, did you?
No, I didn't see any of those in Taft. And, of course, the Japanese were looking down from the heights of the mountain, and they had already pre-zeroed in a lot of their guns. And so there were shells exploding all around us as we went in. And I remember, I mentioned in the book, a big 12-inch piece of shrapnel going over the top of our boat, going through the air like that. And I lost two boats going in. I had the first wave that went into the beach, and then the other five waves came in behind me. And we always had an officer in the front and an officer in the back of the wave picking up. So my officer that was behind me, his job was to pick any survivors up. But I think one of the most emotional things that I ever experienced was as we were going in, we were almost to the coral reef. I couldn't, and landing boat, I couldn't go over the coral reef. So I was to make sure they were, the tractors were on site in the right place, and my job was to turn around once I got them there. So as I was turning around, the Japanese hit two of my tractors as they climbed up on the coral reef. But there was a Marine torpedo bomber who was doing something way beyond the call of duty. It wasn't his place. He didn't have to be there. But he flew right down the coral reef right in front of me, and his gunners were strafing the beach. And the gunner in the back stopped long enough. He turned around, and he waved to the troops. And about that time, a Japanese shell hit the plane, flipped over it, flipped on its back, and disappeared into the ocean. And they brought the bodies up a few days later. But just that split second, as he was waving, he was shot down.
And again, that you just said, that crew didn't need to be there, but they were there to try to support you guys. So it was their lives instead of yours.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, again, it was beyond the call of duty.
All your stories in your book are so vivid. Some of them run together. Was it Saipan where you also described that the Japanese guns were centered in on a spot in the water right next to you?
This is true. After my initial landing, my job was to go back to control boat where my commanding officer was to see if there were further orders. So since I finished, I went back. As I pulled up alongside the boat, he said, Vic, he said, the Marines are already calling for water and more ammunition and medical supplies. Can you take three boats and go in? I said, sure can. So there was a Marine officer on the control boat that was communicating with the Marines. And he said, I'm going too. And he jumped in my boat with me. And so we took off. And the first one the 27th, I think, was Marine Regiment, also was a backup. They weren't supposed to land in the initial landing, but the casualties were so heavy, they had to bring them in. And so they had their Buffalo's tractors. So we found one of those, and I told the guy, I said, we need to go into the beach. I need to use your Buffalo. He said, sir, I can't do that. He said, my ramp is not working right. So I said, okay. So we went on. We found another one. Again, it was an Army Buffalo. He said, my battery's low. And this Marine colonel said, I'm going to kill SOB. And he started getting his gun out of the holster. And I said, no, let's move on. We'll find a Marine. So we found a Marine alligator, and we pulled up alongside. This kid came out of the driver's side all by himself. There was no crew in there except this one kid. Blood was running down his face. Apparently he had been shot across the forehead, and blood was running down his face. And he said, I didn't steal it, sir, said to the Marine officer. I didn't steal it, sir. He said, my guys need help. So he went with us. We found two other Marine alligators, and we took them out to the supply ship, and we put medical supplies in one, water in one, and ammunition in the other. And we started back in the beach, and we went to a slot in the coral reef, which had never been tested because the Japanese had owned the islands for 30, 40, 50 years, I don't know how long, and they would never let an American on the island, and they published nothing. So we had no idea how deep the water was when we went through there. So I went through this reef with these three tractors to a Japanese pier that was about 3 or 4 feet above waterline. And I pulled alongside. I told them that we couldn't go in the beach because the beach was just, the Japanese were dropping artillery on it. Just, it was horrible. I knew every time a shell hit, men were being killed or wounded. It was that bad. So I told them to throw the stuff on the dock, and they did. They started throwing the stuff on the dock, and the Japanese snipers started shooting at us, and the bullets were pinging off of the tractors. So I said, we got to get out of here. So they unloaded, and we started back, and we started back out through the slot, and my commander was sitting in this opening with a long pole, trying to find out how deep it was, to find out what size boats we could pull through there. And I started waving at him and telling him to turn and get the heck out of there. And finally, at the last minute, he finally figured out what I was doing, and he turned around and left. And I had to send the tractors through because they were slower. And then I came in behind him, and I don't think I was 100 yards through that slot until the Japanese artillery, which they had zeroed in on it apparently before, but their communications was terrible. They were terrible. So apparently they just got the word to fire. So when I looked back, the water looked like somebody had taken an egg beater and beat the water. It was just so many shells coming in. It was just foaming. If we'd been in there, we wouldn't have made it. So, but we got through there without any trouble.
So if your commander hadn't moved out of the way and you were still stuck there, you wouldn't be talking to me right now.
That's right. If he had just stayed there and he'd have plugged up the channel because it wasn't very big for us to get through. Yeah.
How many of those close calls like that did you have? Because it seems like there were quite a few.
Oh, not many, I don't think.
Do you need your toes to count them?
Like I say, I had nothing but respect for the Marines. My job was so much easier than theirs. I thought they were the boys I needed the hats off to.
Thing was, you kept volunteering to do more than just your job, as is evident from reading your book, The Gator Navy. And another thing I read in there with interest, because I've talked to a lot of guys who are on Saipan, a lot of them have discussed how disgusting and disturbing it was to them that so many civilians took their own lives there, jumping off that cliff because they'd been told lies about what Americans might do to them. And in your book, there's a pretty similar story there where you actually came upon some civilians who were contemplating that?
Well, after we moved on the beach, I left the ship and became part of the boat pool that was on the island. My friend Sid Cohen and I decided that we would go visit this commander that we had met on the LST and see if he made it. So we went over to Marine headquarters, and sure enough, he was there. And he said, the Japanese surrendered. He said, getting ready to go up the island. You want to go with us? We said, sure. And he said, what kind of a gun do you have? Well, we had our pistols and our holster. He said, those pea shooters that you're carrying, you need a man's gun. So went over to an area where the Marines had behind the lines, where if a Marine were killed or wounded, they'd pick up his gun and bring it back to this place, and they would cannibalize these guns and put the guns together so that they had spare guns. So he had told this guy, pick out a couple of good guns for these swabbies. And so he gave us a couple of M1s. And so we got in the truck with him and took off, went across the island and then up the other side. And about two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way up on the other side, we ran into some Marines. And there was a Marine major there. And so we pulled the truck over, and the colonel wanted to know what was going on. There was a group of Marines in a circle and had a little boy about 10, 12 years old, and they were just talking to him, and the kid was crying, and it was a mess. And the colonel started chewing on the major, what are you doing to this boy? And so we found out that this boy had come up and told the major there was some Japanese who wanted to surrender in a cave down by the water. So he'd sent a patrol down with this boy. When he got down, the Japanese ambushed and killed the whole patrol. So the Marines' buddies were not happy with this boy that had led them into this ambush. But they had some prisoners there, some civilians, and he said, you guys, would you take them with you to the prison camp? So the colonel volunteered us. So Sid and I had to get on the back of the truck with our M1s, and they put the prisoners in this truck, and we took off. We went up around the end of the island. It was like a Western, something you'd see out of a Western movie. There were Japanese dead behind rocks, hanging over rocks, behind buildings. Some of them had tied themselves up in palm trees, and they'd been shot out of the palm trees. They were hanging like dolls on the end of a string blowing in the wind. And we went around the end of the island, started down the other side, and all of a sudden we ran into a lot of Japanese civilians again. So the Japanese that we had in the truck started hollering and yelling in Japanese that we couldn't understand what it was. So we pulled over, and all these Japanese started running and jumping in the truck. They were packed in like sardines in there. And that was where they were jumping off the cliff, right there. They were jumping off this cliff, and to mothers and children holding hands and jumping in the water, killing themselves. They had been told that the Marines would kill them all, rape the women, and kill it. So they had no idea. So, but the Japanese in the truck that we had apparently saved lives by telling them we were okay. Don't jump. I know what they were saying. But anyway, when we pulled in, they all just swarmed into the truck. So we took all we could, and little did we know that that was the place where they were jumping in, the publicity we'd get in later years. But as we started on down the road, we finally came to a Marine roadblock. And the Marine came out, held his head up, and he came up to Colonel. He says, "Where in the so-and-so did you come from?" And the Colonel says, "We came around the island." He said, "Don't you know that Japanese haven't surrendered yet?" He said, "Well, I've been told they'd surrendered." He says, "No, they haven't surrendered yet." So we went behind the Jap lines all the way through them. I think the only thing that saved us the fact we had those Japanese civilians on the truck, and they were amazed at what are these guys doing here? Nobody ever fired a shot at us. So finally, well, it was about 4 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, we got the official notice that the Japanese had surrendered.
So you didn't know you were saving their lives, and they didn't know they were saving your lives.
That's right. It was a mutual thing.
The one last thing I wanted to ask you about, Honor Flight, because Kern County Honor Flight took you to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial. We heard about all those close calls. We heard you told us a story I'm thinking of now of that torpedo bomber where the guy waved to you and then they went down. And then you go to that memorial and see all those gold stars representing 400,000 Americans who didn't come home.
It was very sobering again, and it was a wonderful experience. I think every veteran should try to go. I don't know of anything that the country could do that was better than that, really. I noticed, there's an Atlantic part of the memorial and a Pacific part of the memorial. And I noticed they have battles there described like in the Pacific. I was amazed at 3 or 4 of the battles they had there I had been in. And I saw other gentlemen there that were telling their buddies they're looking, and they were choked up in tears.
And I know you experienced that too, and I know you're feeling it right now. I just want to say in closing, thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for writing this phenomenal book to help us understand what it was like. Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you want us to know?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. They have my book at Annapolis, and as part of the Navy archives, and they ordered a second one. Good. And so it will be part of naval history, and that makes me feel very proud.
As well he should be, and I know Kern County is proud of him in California. Grand Marshal of the Bakersfield Veterans Day Parade on his 102nd birthday, Victor Killingsworth. It's time for our first break, but when this special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes continues, in Las Vegas on Veterans Day, it was a day to remember that city's last Pearl Harbor survivor. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to this special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes, where again we hope to encourage you to treat every day like Veterans Day. In Las Vegas on Veterans Day, the casino industry usually rolls out the red carpet for those who have served. I keep hearing about the South Point Casino and its free Veterans Day buffet for two. But as veterans from many eras took advantage of those special arrangements this Veterans Day, there was a more somber occasion at a Masonic lodge just a couple of blocks from Las Vegas City Hall. A memorial service for Ed Hall, the last known Pearl Harbor survivor in the Las Vegas area who passed away November 2nd at the age of 99. Ed was just a teenager getting ready for breakfast in the mess hall at Hickam Field on Oahu on December 7th, 1941.
So I'm back by the sink scrubbing out this frying pan, and Alex has started the air compressor. I heard it running, and then all of a sudden I heard, boom! I looked around at that air compressor. What's wrong with that thing? I turned back around and continued scrubbing the pan, and another whoomp. And I looked at that thing, and then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside. So I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue. Hangar 7 and 9 had blown up, and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire, and this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. But he had to pull up to miss the building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was. And I could see him. So then I went running out, hollering for Alex, where is everybody? Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided, I got to hide someplace. Oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. Yeah, things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out, started yelling for Alex, and I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air, looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, curse me out, you're going to get killed, get under here. And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the heck with the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there, and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, it always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, stop, stop. I need you, I need you. I said, who are you? He said, I'm a medic. We got wounded. We got to get him to the hospital. So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars, picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a .45 automatic. I figured, well, his guts were spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his .45. I never cleaned that belt either. It still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second, or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck, and we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab that just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat, not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out and went to shut the door, he says, "My God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof." I look at it, my Lord, where did it? And then I realized the tires had been shot out and these dang gum bullets came through the roof of the cab, number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron. The rest of my tour during the war was spent in Air Corps Supply. I transferred to Air Corps Supply, and I spent the rest of the war as a supply person throughout the Pacific. So that's about the extent of December the 7th, 41.
Well, I've got a few questions to ask you about all that, and I think a lot of people can feel and understand a little more what it must have been like from hearing your description. But I'm curious, that first moment, I mean, you described hearing those explosions while you're in the mess hall, but then when you come out and you see an airplane and it's coming right at you and you see these explosions and this debris flying all around, what did you think was happening? Because nobody knows a war is coming. I mean, had you even considered the possibility that someone could attack you there on Hawaii?
Not at all. It was the furthest thing from our minds. That was the most surprising and devastating day I've ever spent in my life. People just don't realize the feeling that you have, which is actually no feeling at the very moment that is happening. And then all of a sudden it dawns on you. Then it doesn't fully hit you until, like it didn't really hit me until about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon after the attack was all over with. And I realized what I had done in picking up wounded and the dead as to how devastating this attack was. Now, there was another thing that I saw, and I didn't know at the time. From where we were, as I said, the edge of the building was shut off the roof. At that point, as I ran out, I saw this huge explosion from Pearl Harbor. I didn't know it then, but that was the Arizona exploding. See, this all happened. Everything that I'm telling you happened in less than 10 minutes. It didn't take very long, believe me. It all happened so fast. And then, of course, the explosion of the Shaw was another one. I could see the smoke, and I heard the explosion. But I didn't know what had happened at Pearl. But I found out later that was the Arizona. Oh, by the way, speaking of the Arizona, there's one thing a lot of people may not know, that there is 1,177 sailors still in that ship. They were never recovered simply because there was too much going on for the next few days. Preparing defenses, trying to repair ships that could be repaired. The powers that be thought the bodies were secondary. Don't worry about it. Do it later. But then after a while, they decided they would just leave the bodies there as a memorial, and that's what happened. Of course, now I think everybody knows that today, any survivor of the Arizona who passes away can have his ashes reburied in the Arizona if he so desires. A lot of people don't know that.
Well, and I want to hear eventually about your experiences going back there and visiting the Arizona and Hickam Field and everything there. But back on December 7th, I'm just trying to get a feel for this. So you're 18 years old. Your world has just changed. The whole world has just changed. But you mentioned it, no feeling, that sense of shock and some kind of numbness that you can't feel. It's so extreme that you can't even feel it at first. So you're going. You're driving this truck. You're picking up dead bodies. You're picking up the wounded. How far was that trip to the hospital from where you were?
Anywhere from 4 to about 6 or 7 blocks.
And as you make these trips back and forth, does it ever strike you that you're putting yourself in danger by doing that?
No, I never thought about that. All I thought about was trying to get help to people. I never even thought about the risk that I might be taking. Cecil Jacobs and I, we were both, we just couldn't understand what was happening, really. And we were too scared to be scared, if you follow what I mean. We just did what we thought we had to do. People that needed help.
I guess when you get out of the truck and you see the tires are shot out and then there's bullets in the cab between where the two of you are sitting, it kind of hits home that that you were in danger. But when did you grasp the magnitude of what happened, the scope of what happened, and the reality that this is war?
Oh, that must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when things did calm down somewhat. I mean, the attack was over and all of that. The attack actually was over about, what, 10:20, 10:30? The second wave finished and they left.
But you guys don't know that. It's not like they gave you a signal, said, hey, it's over now. You don't know if anything else is coming.
No, we didn't know. We didn't know. We were still anticipating. Every time a plane, even ours, would fly over, we know, oh, God, here they come again. And, of course, you know, we shot down, I believe it was 6 of our own planes that night, and that was a scary thing. We thought it was going to be an invasion now. It was a very scary time. Once you realized what had happened and your thoughts got together and you realized, my God, we're at war. We've been attacked. I was damn near killed. Oh, my God, what else is going to happen? Are they coming back again? It was a frightening situation, especially that night.
And can you paint a picture for us of just at Hickam Field, the devastation that occurred there and the contrast between what Hickam looked like before the attack and in the aftermath?
Well, Hickam Field was one of the most beautiful bases I have ever seen in my life. It was new. It wasn't even completed yet. Now, I'm guessing. I really don't know. But from what I remember, that base was about 70% complete. There were supposed to be 20 hangars, and there was 3 and 5. Why there was 3 and 5, I've never been able to find out. There was 3 and 5, 7 and 9, 11 and 13, 15 and 17, and that was on the west end of the base, or the west half. And on the eastern half, the mountainside half, there was supposed to be hangars, and there was number 2 and number 4. Then there was supposed to be 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, and 20. I may be wrong on the numbers, but anyway, I know there was hangars 2 and 4, and there was supposed to be more. Then we had the million-dollar barracks, they called it, because it did cost just a little over $1 million to build that beautiful building. There was 9 wings, 3 stories high, and those barracks were absolutely devastated. They were bombed and strafed, and the marks are still in the building. They'll never be repaired. They're preserved there, too, as a remembrance of December the 7th, 41. And that building was so badly damaged that they could only reuse, if my memory serves me right, the first 2 floors. The top floors were, for the most part, were rendered useless. But that was one beautiful building. Then you had in front of that building the most beautiful parade ground. And that parade ground ran toward Pearl Harbor, and there was a main street. Then there was the headquarters building. And on the other side of the headquarters building, still going toward Pearl Harbor, was another beautiful parade ground. And at that parade ground, on the right, going toward Pearl Harbor, you had houses, homes, that for what we call the first 3 grades of the enlisted men, that would be master sergeants, tech sergeants, staff sergeants. And then on the left side were beautiful homes for the high-ranking officers, the generals, the colonels, and then behind that were individual homes for officers on the left and enlisted personnel on the right, married personnel. It was one beautiful building, beautiful, beautiful base. And I went back. I'm not sure what year it was that they turned that beautiful parade ground in front of the building, turned it into a parking lot. That broke my heart. That broke my heart. That was such a beautiful area.
Well, I think the first to mess with that beauty and disrupt that peace would have been the Japanese that morning. And so you're looking at all this, and you see destroyed hangars, shot up runways, the barracks decimated. What does that do to you and your fellow airmen emotionally to see that, to witness that?
Mostly it made us all mad as hell. Oh, the cursing that went on, and oh, man, we really had a field day cursing those people. To me, I wouldn't buy a Japanese car on a bet. I'm still American-made, man, and I just can't understand people buying all these foreign cars, and I hope you're not driving one.
I'll plead the fifth right now. Don't want this interview to end just yet. So you've seen what happened at Hickam. And you mentioned, without knowing what it was, you saw the explosion of the Arizona and then that magazine just blowing everything in the air on the Shaw. At what point did you actually see the aftermath of what had happened there next door at Pearl Harbor?
Oh, that took a while because we were busy in our own place there trying to get things squared away. And I just can't tell you. Our trucking company, we worked our butts off. As a matter of fact, it was 3.5 days before I ever got into a bed. I caught naps in the trucks while they were loading, unloading, or whatever. I'd catch a little nap. But it had to be at least 3 days before I ever crawled into a bed itself.
And what were you guys doing that whole time?
Mostly cleaning up. For instance, now we had to move all of the food that was salvageable from the big mess hall. Oh, by the way, there's something interesting. There was a mess hall, the dining area, was so big, you could have actually put 6 basketball courts in it. And it was devastated. It was ruined. There was 14 people killed in the mess hall. 8 of them were cooks that had ran into a walk-in refrigerator for protection. And it was a victim of a direct hit, and concussion killed them. They had no wounds on them, just the concussion killed them. And that kitchen and that whole mess hall was just absolutely devastated. Couldn't use it anymore. As a matter of fact, they made a gymnasium out of it.
So for those 3.5 days afterwards, you're moving food, you're moving supplies, you're cleaning up the debris, rubble?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it all had to be cleaned up. Somebody had to do it. And, of course, we were the only trucking company on the base. I think we had about 20 or 25 trucks, 2.5-tonners, a few pickups, and a few ton-and-a-halves. But they were all busy. We were busy day and night for about 3 or 4 days.
You mentioned for us a little bit ago the names of 3 guys you knew that were killed at Hickam that day. Do you remember when you found out about that and what that was like for an 18-year-old kid to know these buddies are gone?
I know I was talking to somebody, and they told me Kelly was killed. I don't guess I found out about the others until some years later when I went back to Hickam the first time. They had the monument by the flagpole, and they heard the names on the killed in action. That's when I found out about the other two.
You mentioned the flagpole. That's one of the iconic images of December 7th. Here's a rendering of it right here on a program from a memorial service. You see the smoke from the barracks in the background and that flagpole towering over the scene with the stars and stripes flying amidst the smoke. When you look at that image, what comes to mind?
The horrible day and the beautiful flag defending this country as a symbol. It makes me proud. The flag of this country makes me proud every time I see it.
And Ed Hall made his fellow Pearl Harbor survivors and the victims of that fateful day proud every time he told their story. On Veterans Day 2022 in Las Vegas, Ed was laid to rest under the flag you heard him say he loved so much. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, what about the veterans coming out of our armed forces now? We'll learn about a program that's helping some of them find pathways to life-changing education. If you didn't thank the vets in your life on Friday, it's not too late to thank them now. Our special Veterans Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EEC. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Veterans Day 2022. You know, when I went to Syracuse University at the tail end of last century, I heard stories of how that school had been a hotbed for veterans returning from World War II. But what about the veterans who finish up their military service here in the 21st century? How do they transition to civilian life, and how do they access the educational benefits that they've earned? Many colleges and universities have special programs along those lines. My alma mater there in central New York remains on the forefront of serving veterans, having invested heavily in its far-reaching Institute for Veterans and Military Families. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. I know we have a lot of listeners in Hillsdale, Michigan, where Hometown Heroes airs a couple of times each weekend on WRFH. And Hillsdale College there offers a special scholarship called the Freedom Scholarship just for veterans. Not only is it a full scholarship, it is privately funded, so it doesn't even tap into GI Bill benefits, leaving those available for further education if desired. Hillsdale also recently launched its Center for Military History and Grand Strategy. I have some links online to that, and also to the Veterans Education Program at Fresno State in Central California, the area I'm blessed to call home. This idea brings a little different twist, recognizing that some veterans never end up accessing their GI Bill benefits because of some of the roadblocks that can get in the way. Daniel Bernard is the director of Fresno State's Veterans Education Program.
So the Veterans Education Program at Fresno State is specifically designed for veterans and service members who otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to come straight into Fresno State as undergraduate students. It gives them an opportunity to take coursework with Fresno State faculty, and that coursework is what's considered the CSU Golden Four, and that's English, math, critical thinking, and quantitative reasoning. And by completing those successfully, what they really demonstrate to the university is that they're able to be successful students at the university. And when they complete the coursework, they then matriculate or become full-time undergraduate degree-seeking students. One of the unique features of the program is that, again, as I mentioned, it's taught by Fresno State faculty, and it's all in the same place, so it's cohort-based. And what we're really trying to do there is leverage the camaraderie that many of our service members experience in the service. And so we bring the faculty into a dedicated classroom space that's a smart classroom where the instruction takes place. I think the other really unique feature about this program is that we make this program available at no cost to the students who are enrolled in the program. And the way that we're able to do that is to really connect the community to the program, and we use donations to cover the cost of attendance in the program.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, basically this is a
a special on-ramp available to veterans who might otherwise never have the chance to go to college, or it would take a lot more work than this for them to get to that point.
That's exactly right. You can kind of consider it like a parallel admission route specifically for our veterans and service members, because what we found is that oftentimes there's unique challenges or barriers for our service members, and it's through no fault of their own. So for example, a service member deployed might choose to take a couple courses while they're out there thinking that they're getting ahead in their college career, only come to find out that they're actually now considered a transfer student and need to go complete the undergraduate transfer requirements in order to be eligible for admission into the university. But through this program, we're able to waive those types of requirements. And again, by getting them that fundamental GE area coursework, demonstrate to the university that they're ready, able, and willing to be successful college students here at Fresno State.
And am I also hearing that the number of veteran students who have the chance to take advantage of this pathway depends on the generosity of the community and how much is donated to make it possible?
Yeah, it's really based on two factors. One you just identified, which is our ability to cover the fees or the expense of the program, which by and large, the largest expense of the program is going to be making sure that we're compensating the faculty for teaching and voluntary overload, because these are Fresno State faculty members teaching their core curriculum. The other thing that really kind of limits the size of each cohort is we found the best practices, which is a smaller classroom size. So we can go up to about 20 students, but we found that really the sweet spot for best practices in terms of student success has been between 12 and 15 students per cohort.
And I'm sure you could give me, you know, dozens of success stories here, but if you had to explain what you see as the impact of this program and the difference it's making for some of these veterans, how would you put that into words?
To your point, I could probably point to a lot of different students who have their own success story. But I think overall, what the program is doing fundamentally is removing barriers. It's demystifying the college experience. It's creating a welcoming atmosphere. And it's showing our veterans and service members that they belong on Fresno State's campus, that they can be successful here, and that we're welcoming them with open arms.
And if someone is hearing this, and let's say they're a veteran and they didn't know this was possible, that they could make their way into college this way, or if it's someone who says, wow, they're doing this for veterans, I want to support that, I want to donate. Speak to both of those scenarios and how people can get engaged.
Yeah, for either of those parties, I would encourage them to visit cge.fresnostate.edu. There you can find information both on the program itself, Veterans Education Program, whether you're interested in participating in the next cohort as a service member or a veteran, or if you're interested as a community member in supporting our cohorts and our student veterans complete the program. If you go to that website, which is again cge.fresnostate.edu, you can find information underneath the Veterans Education Program.
So with regard to what the veterans receive and or experience when they become a part of a cohort here with the Veterans Education Program, it sounds like a pretty all-encompassing situation.
That's correct. So in addition to bringing the Fresno State faculty into the dedicated classroom space in a cohort, what we do is we provide additional resources and support for our student veterans, which includes things like tutoring. We cover the cost of textbooks. We cover parking passes, ID cards, supplemental instruction. Really, what we're trying to do is make sure that there are as few barriers as possible for their success while they're here at Fresno State and they feel supported.
So that's the director of Fresno State's unique Veterans Education Program. But let's hear from a veteran who has experienced the difference it can make firsthand.
My name is Frederick Lisitsa. I'm a first-generation Ukrainian-American. I was in the service for 4 years as a sonar technician in the Navy on surface ships tracking submarines. I was medically retired last year in September of 2021. My first week in Fresno, because I was stationed in Virginia, and my first week here in Fresno, I had walked into the VEP, Veteran Education Program office, and spoke to a coordinator. It had already been a few weeks into the semester, so I thought I had lost my chance, because you have to start in the fall and continue in the spring. You can't just join in the middle. But I was given the benefit of the doubt. I really wanted to, you know, get into school. I had dropped out of high school when I was 15 and started working, and then in my 20s joined the military. So I didn't have any type of like opportunity, and I did not have any confidence in my ability to go to school either. Like, even though you would say that being a sonar technician is complicated work, you still only need to learn a few things and, you know, repeat that whenever you go in or on deployment. So when I was given the benefit of the doubt and that, you know, maybe I'd be able to catch up because I'd have to still turn in all the work that the cohort had done in the 4 weeks prior, I made it through and I went in through the spring semester and was able to graduate. And I was still anxious when I started my first semester this fall at Fresno State, but I realized that the classes that they gave us were the perfect mix. It was comms, English, math, you know, even a University One class to help us get acquainted on campus and know what to check out of the library, what am I allowed to do, where do I go for resources. So by the time that the semester started, I was nervous and I was scared, but I had everything like I needed to function normally as a student. It had been a decade since I'd been in school for anything else other than, like, you know, my job training in the military. So I was really, really happy. And so now I try to spend more of my time, if I'm not busy with school, helping with the VEP, with volunteering, because I would not be, I don't know where I'd be, because that was such a volatile week for me, that first week coming back from the military. And I was welcomed with open arms and it gave me an outlet to pour all my energy into. And I used it well and I'm really thankful for it.
And what kind of degree are you pursuing here at Fresno State now?
I'm pursuing a pre-veterinary degree. So all of my classes are science-based, and I haven't seen these things in a long, long time. It was scaring me in the first week, but I'm in the groove of it now, and it's working out, and it's working well.
And what's it been like connecting, you know, when you were in the Veterans Education Program cohort, connecting with your fellow veterans? What did that do for you to have them there shoulder to shoulder with you?
Speaking honestly, I thought that I was just trying to, you know, join the program, get through school, not trying to make friends or anything like that. But I was surprised with the fact that I was able to relate with everybody into the room. You know, it didn't even take 10 minutes. We were able to talk about, like, our experiences and laugh about things that we've all been through. There was, like, San Diego sailors or a Virginia sailor. Doesn't matter. The ship still looks the same on the inside. So I was surprised with how many friends I made and how genuinely it was actually, like, it didn't feel like a drag to go to class, even when there was something I was scared of turning in, because I could talk with the cohort, you know, the classmates. And when, and now, you know, a lot of us, even we graduated in May of this year, and a lot of us still go out to town together, talk outside of it. And I'm not from Fresno either, so I only have my wife and my extended family here. So I was able to get friends and have a base of, and a support network, which is what a lot of veterans don't get when they get out of the service.
And what does Veterans Day mean in your world?
What I can tell now, because a veteran community is different in a way than an active duty community, right? And the experiences of veterans are so different from depending on what era that they serve in. So even if I had an easier time through my deployments compared to others in different eras, like, some of the stories I've heard makes me appreciate the holiday more than just a day off, because it's honoring, like, the experience of everybody that put in their time, whether they suffered or had an easier time in. It's all the same at the end of the day, because we can exchange stories. And it's not about, like, the thanks that people give us, you know, it's more about, like, the experience that we share with each other as veterans and how we can make a community out of that.
The veterans community from generation to generation has given the rest of us so much. And why can't we allow Veterans Day to be a reminder of how we can support our veterans community every day? You can learn more about Fresno State's Veterans Education Program and the other initiatives I mentioned today at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have on the radio today, but thanks so much for listening. For every one of you veterans who's listening right now, hopefully you heard it a lot on Veterans Day, but let me add a personal thank you for serving our country. I know you know better than I do that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.